Good morning, everybody. How we doing? Great. I heard a great. Is there a great over here? I heard a great. It's wonderful. Better than the usual. All right, so we're going to get started this morning with a football story. And no, it's not about Indiana beating Ohio State, but it's a football story. It is. It's not really so much as a football story as a story is within the context of a football setting. My first year at college, I got on the field, I think, for three plays the whole season. The thing that I kind of tucked in the back of my brain and didn't really think about was that when you go and you play a college sport, pretty much everybody on the team was captain of their high school team. So everybody on that team was somehow really good. So I got there, I didn't play much. So I didn't have high hopes for my second season, my sophomore season. And then 10 days before the start of the season, the guy, the starting defensive tackle, the guy who was in front of me, he got hurt, like out for the season hurt, medical red shirt, he left school. And so the coach said, Tommy, you're going to start first game. It's like, okay. And I think he may have been the only person more nervous than me about me starting in that game. So the night before, InterVarsity, the Christian Fellowship on campus, had their large group meeting. And so I went to the meeting, and the guest speaker was talking about Philippians 4:13, which says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And he was talking about it in the context of having faith in God. And he told us that the word confidence literally means with faith, confideo. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And so I'm getting ready for the game, and I'm in the trainer's room, and he's like taping my hands, my wrist, and I'm thinking to myself about what I got to do during the game. I'm thinking about the speaker from the night before. I'm like, Philippians 4:13. I should remember that. So I got a green Sharpie, and on my tape, I wrote Philippians 4:13 and the word confidence. And we went out, and I played well, and we won, and I had that job, that starting job, for the next 3 years. I was like, oh, I should keep writing that Philippians 4:13 on my wrist and confidence. And that was the problem. I moved from having, like, with faith in God to, okay, God, I'm doing this for you. Now you got to do your thing for me, right? I brought God down, and I tried to make him like a little God I could put in my pocket and be like, all right, God, it's time to come out and do your thing. I got a game tomorrow. Let's go. Come on, help me play well. I diminished him. And the problem was, if when we take God from a God who's like this, what is the line from Aladdin? Big giant powers, little tiny living space. You got it, Stace? Itty bitty living space. Thank you. There it is. When we do that to the God of the Bible, when adversity comes our way, we're like, okay, this is the God that I control. And things kind of felt like I had diminished God to such a point that when adversity came my way a few years later, I thought God had abandoned me. So I turned my back on God and I walked away. So the part of Genesis that we're moving into, it's the end of what most scholars consider the first section of Genesis, chapters 1 through 11. And we're going to meet a group of people who do what I did. They took God and they tried to kind of make God at their disposal. They tried to have God in their pocket, try to make him containable. And we'll see what the outcome of that was. Let's give you the big idea before we go any further. The God of the Bible cannot be contained, controlled, or coerced. As we live into this reality, we are better able to live as his image bearers, confident in who he is, confident in who we are. All right, so we're trucking through Genesis. We read about Noah and the flood and his sons. Chapter 10 is another one of those genealogies. It's the long list of hard-to-pronounce names, right? Remember, we did that. There's another one in Genesis 5. And I suggested to you that when we come to these lists, we look for patterns, and then we look for deviations to the patterns. And in Genesis chapter 10, the deviation to the pattern is a guy named Nimrod. That's his name. Unfortunate, but that's his name. The meaning is a little bit cooler than his. The meaning is rebel warrior. And he goes on to, in like a Conan the Barbarian kind of way, found the city of Nineveh and the city of Babylon. Significance of those two places: Nineveh becomes the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Babylon becomes the capital of the Babylonian Empire. Later on in the story of God's people, as they're trying to follow God, they keep getting distracted by these surrounding cultures and people, Assyria, Babylon, and they're like, we want to live like them. We want to talk to their gods. We want their gods to protect us. God said, all right, go ahead, if that's what you want, and he let them go. And God used those conquering empires. They literally came and they took the kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel, southern kingdom of Judah, into captivity. They took them out of their lands, away from their homes, and they brought them into their lands. Those were the descendants of Nimrod. It's going to be important when we get to chapter 11, right? The other thing about chapter 11, if you're reading through Genesis 1, just, you know, chapter by chapter, 1, 2, 3, 4, chapter 11 is a flashback. It actually happens before chapter 10. The biblical authors, when they share these genealogies with us, they go, bup, 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 and then they come back and they go into great detail on one person or one family or one event. And that's what this story in chapter 11 is. Got all that? You sure? My wife's nodding her head, but she has to do that. All right, Genesis chapter 11. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. Shinar, the plain of Shinar, is where Babylon is. It's the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates, modern-day Iraq. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building a city. That is why it is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. All right, a couple quick comments about the text itself. In verse 2, people moved eastward. If you're paying close attention, the story of Genesis is a move eastward. Adam and Eve, when they got kicked out of the garden, they were exited to the east of Eden. The cherubim with the flaming sword was put on that east gate. When Cain was exiled, he moved further east. When Nimrod and his people moved, they moved further east. They're metaphorically and physically moving further away from God. Eden was that place, that overlap of heaven and earth. It was that place where God walked with his people, and humanity is now moving further and further away from him. I already mentioned that Shinar is the plain that's where Babylon is, right? It's Nimrod, it's his descendants in the plain that becomes the capital city of Babylon. They discovered how to make bricks. It's a technological advancement. The bricks were not the problem, right? Technological advancements then and now are neither good nor bad. It's what the people who have those advancements choose to do with them. All right, so now that kind of the crux of the story. Don't put any pictures up yet, Joe. So when you, and if you know the right answer to this, please don't blurt it out. I'm going to kill my point here if you blurt it out. Before I started to study the Bible in earnest, I had a picture of the Tower of Babel. What do you guys think the Tower of Babel looked like? I had a picture of like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but it was straight. Pisa, right? It was straight. Or maybe like the Washington Monument, just like a really, really tall. That is not at all. Go ahead and put up the actual photo. So you can tell this is not like a mountain, that there was some intent to what this was. And if you guys remember, for some of you this will be easier than others, go back to fifth grade social studies, the ziggurats in Sumeria, right? That's what that is. That was a ziggurat. It was a temple, and they were built like with steps. Go ahead and put up the artist's rendering. This is a reconstruction of the, I'm not going to say the word right, Temple of Enemyake. Almost got it. You can see how it's like tiered, right? It goes up and up and up. And the most prominent feature of this thing is the stairs. There's stairs up and down. They look like pyramids, but they're not hollow inside like the pyramids of Egypt were. It's just solid. The only kind of space within a ziggurat is at the top. It's a little room. And that little room had in it a table, a couple of chairs. That's where the people's sacrifice would go. All the food that they would sacrifice would go up onto that table, and there was a bed. Because the whole point, it was called a temple complex. The ziggurat was supposed to serve as like a means of convenience. It's like our rest stop on 95, like stopping at McDonald's. That was this for the gods. Like when the people wanted the gods to come down to them, they built these temples with stairs in them in these little rest stops. So the gods got tired, the gods needed to eat, and the people were able to meet the needs of the gods. The gods needed people to provide for them. And so most, by and large, scholarship tells us that the Tower of Babel was a ziggurat. These people saw that that's how everybody around them communicated with their gods. They brought their gods, they contained their gods, they got them to do what they wanted them to do, right, by building this thing. In this area of the world now, there's 30 of those mounds that I showed you, that first picture. There's probably 30 of them. So, and each one of them was dedicated to a specific deity. The people of Babylon built this one for Yahweh. They thought they could control him. They took a look around them, and they saw how the other peoples were trying to interact with their gods, and like, oh, okay, that's how we should interact with our God. He has needs that we have to meet. And you can put up the next list, Joe. It says they did this to make a name for themselves, right? They didn't just want to make a name for themselves and keep God's name where it was. They brought God down. They tried to contain him. They tried to coerce him. They thought they could manipulate him. That was the sin of the people of Babylon. They so degraded the name of God that it was almost unrecognizable as Yahweh, as the covenant God of the Bible. So there's a scholar, his name is John Walton, and he suggests that the answer to a diminished view of God is a fresh revelation of God. The answer to a diminished view of God is a fresh revelation of God. So these people had taken God and they made him pocket size. And God, throughout this first part of Genesis, God continues to reveal himself to people. Adam and Eve, he showed himself to be creator and he showed himself to be provider. And last week I used the term that God would accommodate himself to people. And just to be really clear, right, that means that God meets people where we're at. He's not lessening himself. He's not changing the rules. He's meeting people where they're at because of his desire for a relationship with us. That's always his priority. His glory, a relationship with us. Adam and Eve knew God as creator, provider. Then they made their bad decision, and God showed himself to be a God of not only justice, but mercy. Cain knew God through his parents as provider and creator and justice and mercy, and then Cain made his bad decision, and he also was able to recognize God as faithful because God protected him even in his mistakes. Noah had all of that, faithfulness, creator, provider, and then he came to know God as one who could have his heart broken by the violence of people towards each other, and as the one who could restore order, right? People brought disorder into God's good creation, and God restored order into the cosmos in and through the flood. And so now God is revealing himself again to the people, saying, look, I am so much bigger than any of these false gods, that any of these other cultures around you, people are worshiping or pouring their hearts out to, or trying to control, or trying to coerce, or trying to manipulate. That doesn't work with me. Doesn't mean I don't want a relationship with you, but we're going to do this God's way, right? That's how we've been defining wisdom, God's way. So last week, this is kind of like a part two from last week. I suggested that the answer was a greater understanding of God's holiness, not just his moral purity and righteousness, but his otherness. And I'm going to give you three different words that expand that sense of otherness. And I'm going to ask you to do some homework, all right? I'm going to ask you to do some homework because we have some other important things we want to do today. So I'm making this a little bit shorter. There's some verses that are going to go up, put up STP, Joe, in the verses. Those references, if you want to take a picture, you want to write them down, I want you to, over the course of this week, I want you to study these passages in light of what I'm about to say. God showed himself to his people then, the people who constructed the Tower of Babel, mistakenly thinking they could control God, and he shows himself to us now as sovereign, as transcendent, and as powerful. All right, those are big sounding words. Sovereign means that God has all the authority. There's nobody that God reports to. He's the boss. He has all the authority. He is completely self-sufficient. He needs no one or nothing else. His desire for us comes purely from his being love. He is totally, like when we think about a king as being sovereign, king has an army to enforce. God doesn't need an army. The king has his parliament or whatever else to make laws. God does that all by himself. All authority, completely self-sufficient. Transcendent. I made this gesture when thinking about God, like big, 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 big. Can I say it again? Big. He's big in his abilities. He's big in his character. He's big in his being. And in such a way that we are limited to words and these mental pictures that we're capable of conjuring. Some of us are better at that than others, but we are limited. So this, we do the best we can trying to understand a transcendent God in words and descriptions of people who experience him and study him. Should I say it one more time? Big, big. And the last one is powerful. All right, so when we think about physics, the formula for power, anybody know what it is? Work divided by time, right? However long it takes you to do something, right? If it takes me 3 hours to move 10 pounds from here to Joe, that's the power ratio, right? Work divided by time. In politics, power, it's influence, the ability to move people and get things done that you want done. In athletics, think of powerlifting. It's the ability to lift as much weight, push, press, pull, as much weight as you can. So in short, we can think of power as the ability to get things done. God, with his words, spoke the cosmos into being. God rose Jesus from the dead, our single biggest enemy. No matter how many technological advancements we've come up with, we haven't figured this one out yet. God's the only one who has, and he wants to share that with us as long as we are trying to live with him and like him and not trying to put him in our pocket and pull him out and use him when we want him and when we need him. All right, I feel bad. I kind of like really, really scrunched this down. But I'm going to ask the band to come back up, and I want to give you guys a few seconds to think about the people of Babel. They wanted God to do what they wanted him to do, when they wanted him to do it. And we are all guilty of this, right? You don't have to answer out loud, but think about, all right, God, I did it this time. I'm in a real jam. Get me out of this one, and I'll stop doing X. Or God, I would really, really, really like this thing, this job, this whatever. Give me that and I'll start doing this. God, I just signed up for recurring giving at Crossroads. It's got to count for something, right? You kind of owe me a little bit, giving more money. C.S. Lewis, this is a paraphrase of C.S. Lewis. God's desire for a relationship with us comes neither from his neediness nor our deserving it. It's simply because he is love. So I want you to take, we're going to take literally a minute. I'm going to give you like 30 seconds of silence. The band is going to just play instrumentally for like 30 seconds. And just have a conversation with God. Share with him those ways that you have tried to cut him down to size so you could keep him in your pocket and get him to do your will. Knowing that when we confess our sins, just like we talked about last week, right? God is faithful and he forgives us because he wants to be in that relationship with us. The people of Babylon came together and they brought God down in their communal act of building this tower. I'm going to invite you, right? You just stay seated as you're having that conversation with God. And then as you're finishing that conversation, I want you to stand. And then as the band, the song starts playing, I want you to join in singing. Because just like that group of people brought God's name down, we can bring his name up with the simple act of prayer and worship. And we do that as individuals and we do that as a community. Sound good?